Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Will Carswell, founder and CEO of Zen Art and Design in Northampton, Massachusetts. Zen Art and Design creates artisanal, hand-designed wooden jigsaw puzzles as well as digital versions. You can find out more at www.zenartdesign.com. That's one word, zenartdesign.com. Needless to say, Will is an avid puzzle creator and enthusiast. Welcome, Will Carswell.
Thank you, Alan.
So tell me, Will, how did all of this begin?
I grew up collecting wooden jigsaw puzzles, and my parents got me into it, especially my mother.
I should confess to everybody, I love your mother. Half for years.
My mother's a wonderful woman, and she, I guess, grew up doing wooden jigsaw puzzles herself, and so started a collection for us. And since the time I was born, I was doing puzzles on top of a mountain in the Berkshires during long summer hours and days, and that's what we would do, and it brought us all together.
Did you work together collaboratively, or did you compete with each other?
Collaboratively, but my sister actually was the best puzzler in the family, so she could do a puzzle in 10 minutes that would take the rest of us hours.
What do you have to do to be a good puzzler? Do you have to have an Einsteinian sort of intellect? What is it that makes somebody? I mean, I can't stand the damn things. You know, it is so hard. I feel like I'm such an idiot. My wife loves to do it, so it's very hard for me to understand. Do you have to have spatial, you know, intelligence? What is it that you do to do these?
Well, it's possible that you may not have found the right puzzle for yourself.
No, it's not.
Well, maybe I'll have to design a puzzle specifically for you.
Yeah.
It'll be the Alan Chartok puzzle.
There'll be some Pete Seeger in it, and, you know, and Murray the dog and things like that. Yeah.
How about a one-piece puzzle?
A one-piece puzzle. I like it.
There we go.
Boom, I did it.
That's our next product line. All right, and we'll call it the Alan Chartok puzzle, and it'll have some of its funds dedicated to a certain mission in your name.
Sure.
Anyway, so my experience is that there are people who do puzzles in different ways. Like, my sister seems to do them in multiple ways. People do them spatially. They look at the lines, the cut lines. They see, because each, in a hand-cut wooden jigsaw puzzle, each one is unique. And so the tabs that interlock are unique. And so some people have the ability to look at those tabs and recognize the shapes. So they don't even look at the image, really. They're looking at the shape and putting them together. Other people are focused on the image and the various colors in the image and the different subjects. For instance, we have a puzzle called Black Bear, and it's a close-up of a black bear face. And at first, it might seem daunting because it's all very dark. It's just the same sort of colors. But when you look more closely at it and divide it into hundreds of pieces, the fur goes different ways, and there are gradations, variations in the colors. And so at 4 in the morning, when you're trying to put one more piece in, you're noticing, oh, this fur goes this way, this fur goes this way. And so you can tell which way they go. So some people focus very much on, that's focusing on the sort of subject matter within the image. Other people just like to do landscapes, for instance. My mother loves to do landscapes because there's lots of different layers. They're not necessarily slightly easier, but they can be more enjoyable for some. Not everyone likes to do macro shots of something very close up. But I've got puzzler clients who have wanted the most difficult, tormenting puzzles you can imagine. Puzzles I wouldn't want to do myself. Matter of fact, I've created puzzles that I will not do.
Well, how do you do it? I mean, do you take a scene, for example, and then you sort of draw lines through it, and that becomes the puzzle?
How do I create them?
The pieces, yeah.
Well, I used to hand cut them. So I started hand cutting them as gifts for my family a long time ago.
What do you mean hand cutting? I don't get it.
So with a scroll saw. I had a handmade scroll saw. And
what's a scroll saw?
It's like a bandsaw, only with a very, very thin blade that's actually 8/1000ths of an inch thick.
Is it electric?
Yeah. You plug it in, and it's about an arm length long or longer. It's got a 20-inch throat where you can cut up to 20 inches or 24 inches, depending on the scroll saw you have. And the blades break every 2 minutes, and you replace the blades. So I started hand-cutting them for my family as presents, and it turned out—
How old were you when you started?
Well, the first one I made, I think I must have been 11 or 12, and it was absolutely horrible. I cut it on a bandsaw, and so you can't cut a puzzle on a bandsaw. I mean, it's just too thick of a blade.
Remind me what a bandsaw is.
A bandsaw just has a thicker blade. Say it's like a half-inch blade, and you can't make tight turns.
But it's also electric.
It's also electric. So in the early days, they made them with fret saws and other things that were handheld. But I started making them for my family, and it turned out I had a knack for it. So I kept making them, and then I started a hobby company called the Berkshire Puzzle Company. And
how old were you when you did that?
I was in my early 30s.
Let's stop there for a minute and let's catch up on. I know where you were raised. You were raised in Brooklyn, right?
Well, in Manhattan.
In Manhattan.
My father was born in Brooklyn, and he was raised in Brooklyn.
His father was a very important judge in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
In fact, most people who know the family history knows that he was sort of the go-to guy, one of the most important people in all of Brooklyn, right, at the time.
Yeah.
That's a lot of responsibility to have, right?
It is.
And your father was just recently passed, who was a wonderful man. He was a top New York lawyer, right?
Yeah.
So where did you go to private school? Because I know you went to private school.
I did have the privilege of going to a number of the best schools. And so I went to schools in Manhattan.
Which ones?
Well, I went to a school called Buckley.
Oh, I know that, yeah. I didn't like those kids. I always thought they were snotty.
Yeah, I left there as soon as I could, tell you the truth. It was one of the best educations I got in my entire life.
Yeah.
I mean, college had nothing on Buckley, and that was, I'm talking fifth grade, and that was the best education I ever got.
That's just so interesting, because just this morning I was listening to NPR, and there's a story on about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and how he said people who don't know anything basically ought not to be allowed to vote. That you have to know stuff in order to vote properly. Now, I think he was sort of sassing the Trump people, but of course, he got deluged with people who say, hey, listen, we had poll taxes for years. But I began to think about it and say, hey, the best people with the best chances in society are the people who have been taken care of, and therefore, there are more Republicans than Democrats who have been wealthized, a word I just made up. So what do you think of that?
I'm kind of a put your boots on kind of guy, and I believe in that everyone at any moment has the ability to realize themselves and do whatever they want. I've created the life that I want a couple of times out of nothing.
And we're going to get there.
And although I had a background that allowed me, I'll tell you this, when I was in grad school, I went to...
Studying what?
I got my master's in sustainable development management, which had to do with basically consumption and production methods in industrialized countries and how it affected generations of people trapped in debt in less developed countries or in developing countries.
So what do you do with that when you get that degree?
That's a very good question. And it turned out it was very difficult to do anything with it. And I tried for a long time to be, I was part of what became the Green Movement. Not that the Green Movement didn't exist.
How old are you now, Will?
45.
So you're a kid.
Yeah.
Well, you are compared to my 75. That's young.
Yeah.
Very, very young.
Yeah, and 75 is the new 60. I don't know what 45 is. But.
Well, I don't know what it is,
yeah.
But I don't like it. So, so I want to have some semblance of order here.
All right.
So you go to the Buckley School. You're done with that. Where do you go next?
I went to Milton Academy.
Milton Academy, you know, some very famous people went to Milton, like our wonderful ex-governor, Deval Patrick, who I miss every day as a citizen of Massachusetts.
Yeah.
He went to Milton Academy, right.
Yeah,
so
I loved Milton Academy.
So did he. What'd you do there?
I was a musician.
What'd you play?
I had a band. I actually just sang in this band.
What's the name of the band?
The Joe Dooley Band.
The Joe Dooley Band. Who is Joe Dooley?
I have the slightest idea. I don't know how we came up with that.
Okay.
Oh, I know what it was. You know what it was? It was from a recording from Woodstock. And there was a guy, the announcer says, would Joe Dooley please come to the information booth, please? Would Joe Dooley please come to the information booth, please? Something about his, I don't know what it was, something strange.
I had a friend named David Epstein. His mother's dog's name was Dooley.
Yeah.
Yeah, Dooley. Okay, so that doesn't mean anything, of course.
No.
What are the chances? Okay, so you go to Milton Academy, you sing with a band, and you graduate?
No, I left.
You left.
And went to North of Mount Hermon. And I went to North of Mount Hermon for 1 year.
Why did you do that?
At the time, I've never been the type, so... My father was a very stoic man.
He was indeed.
I mean, he was a Scot of Scots, and his father was, I never knew his father, but was even more Scottish.
And he played the bagpipes, did he?
My father, there were bagpipes heard in my family. If my father played them, I did not know about it. But
well, I knew his brother very well. In fact, was related by marriage, by cousinhood
yes.
to his brother. And his brother had bagpipes on the wall. I know that.
Yes, and apparently played them once a year at a certain time, I was recently told. My father, I don't think, ever played the bagpipes, but maybe as a kid he did. But he was a very stoic man and a great example in many ways of a way to live your life. I grew up, he wore suits on Saturdays. when he wasn't going into the office.
Why'd he do that?
That's who he was. He was very businesslike in his fatherhood and in his life, and he was not a cuddly man, but he had love for a great many things.
And he had a dignity to him which was extraordinary.
Did. And it permeated, I mean, you could feel it for a mile around.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, you know.
So I was, my father worked for the same firm and did other things, but for more than 50 years.
Other things like being Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Treasury and being the guy who got the Iranian hostages released. Other things like that, right?
Yes, some amazing things. And he was involved also with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
He was indeed.
And
he was the president, I think, for a while, right?
Yeah. Quite a long time and did a number of other things and also helped a number of other people out doing things. But he had worked for the same firm for, for a bunch of decades. And like a lot of people from his generation, and that was just not who I was. And at Milton Academy, it seemed like my life was all planned out. Like you graduate, then you go to wherever you go to, some, a highfalutin school, and then you work for the same corporation for 50 years, and then, you retire or whatever, or you don't retire, actually. You just keep working. And that didn't resonate with me. And I needed a change. So I went to North Mount Hermon and found this amazing freedom there. And teachers, I mean, my teachers at Milton Academy were fantastic.
Was it a quote, progressive school?
Yeah, it was like Milton Academy, only it was a little freer. And the professors allowed me to do things in a creative way that I wasn't allowed to do at Milton Academy.
For example?
I had this teacher, John Adams, an English teacher.
Sounds like a familiar name.
Yeah, it is. And he was fantastic. He was absolutely fantastic. And he would take... And I was, I would say, somewhat rebellious.
How rebellious? Smoked pot, did sex, what were you?
I would say rebellious in terms of, like, I was looking for a connection with, life and a higher power. And it came out, my father did not understand that, and at one point said I was a nihilist, and eventually I found
when that... When did you find out what a nihilist was?
When did I find out? When he told me that. And so I didn't know what it meant at the time, but... So I
somebody once called me a Trotskyite. I didn't know what that meant either.
Well, so I found in Eastern philosophy texts all the words I'd been thinking for many years, for years, and they'd been written for over 2,000 years, and found out that I wasn't making stuff up, and that, it was something that I very much resonated with, which is Taoism and Zen Buddhism. And so that's part of the reason my company is called Zen Art and Design. And it's just something.
Could you explain a little about Zen to me? Because, I hear it, I use it myself, but I'm a phony. What's involved in it?
In Zen?
Yeah.
In a very simple, Zen is everything and Zen is nothing. And so it's kind of, for me, the practice, I just started doing archery again. I just built an archery range for my sons and myself, and I'm loving it. I haven't done it in 30 years or over 30 years. And there's a book by Eugene Herigel called Zen and the Art of Archery. And it's about the practice of meditation through archery, and it's this, and it's a discipline, that you use to focus in on having an empty mind and letting thoughts come and go without lingering on them.
If there's such a thing as an opposite Zen person, I'm the opposite Zen person. I can't let go.
I think a Zen person would say that's impossible. If everything is Zen, then you are Zen as well.
Well, no, I'm
the Zen Allen,
but I'm anti-Zen. I mean, I start worrying about a problem. I was worrying about a skunk in my trap the other night. I couldn't stop thinking about the skunk in the trap. And, a good Zen person would have said, let that go until tomorrow morning. You'll take a look at it and see
maybe
what the problem is. No?
Well,
maybe.
Okay, there's a Zen story, if we have time for a story. Zen story. There's a farmer and his wife and his son, and they cherish above all else their son. And this is a long time ago. And the son, they're depending on him to bring financial success to the family. They're struggling with a farm and, they're getting by, but they're depending on the son. They raise their son to bring financial success to the family. But one day, a herd of wild horses, and they go out and they get some of the horses and they bring them in and they start to tame them. The son is taming one of them, or whatever you do with wild horses, breaking them, and is thrown from the horse and breaks his leg. And the neighbors come over and they say, oh, what bad luck. Your son broke his leg. And the father says, well, good luck, bad luck, who knows? And the next day, the army comes and they're recruiting. There's a war going on. They recruit all of the young men in the town to go to war, and they can't bring the son because he's got a broken leg. So they bring everybody but the son. The son stays home, and the neighbors come over and they say, oh, what good luck. He says, good luck, bad luck, I don't know. So the point of the story is it goes on and on like this.
I know. And by the way, this story is told in every religious group, including, you may call it Zen, but I've heard it told by religious Jews who say the same thing.
There you go. So Zen is everything.
Zen is everything.
So there's the Zen Allen.
Zen Allen. Okay, but I love this conversation. So let's talk a little bit about your mom. Now, you know, I'm so old now, I mean, 75, and I remember my mother and your mother knew each other. I think my mother actually hired your mother at one point or another. I don't know. She's a social worker.
Yeah.
And when I went to Washington for my master's degree to American University, I got invited to your parents' house. Now, as I remember it, this is a very interesting phenomenon because they deny it. As I remember it, they lived in a really fancy brownstone. He was like Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Treasury.
So this is in the 60s?
Absolutely. Kennedy was the guy. So I go to the house.
But this was in New York?
No, this was in Washington.
Oh, before I was born.
Yes, before you were born.
Yeah.
I hate that. But I go to this house, and it's a brownstone, and it's in the middle of Washington, and they have gotten me a date. The woman who they have gotten went to some junior college like Mary Martha Washington Junior College. I don't really remember the name of it. And she was like 6'2". For all the people who may be listening now, I'm going down, but I'm now 5'5". This is a beautiful girl. And she was really into riding a horse.
All right.
She didn't break her leg, though. She was really into riding. And we had this conversation, and they served artichokes. Now, I had never seen, a poor Jewish guy from Manhattan, I had never seen an artichoke in my life. I had no idea how you ate it. Did you pull those stupid things off and, you know, suck them in, or what did you do? And when I got to the Berkshires all these years ago, I had a column, I guess, in the Eagle, and I decided I had nothing to write that week, so I was going to talk about this time. I went to Washington and was invited by some really wealthy people to their beautiful brownstone, and they got me a date with a woman who was 6'2", who was at the table. And I was wearing my suit. You could see her face in it. It was so shiny. The point really being that I wrote it, and your mom said to me, "Was that me?" And I said, and she said, because it was me, A, we weren't rich, and B, it wasn't a mansion that we were in, as we were subletting somebody's house or something like that. I love your mother, as I said before, because she is a splendid woman. But she's a Vanderbilt, right?
Well, it's true that we weren't rich, and I'm sure it wasn't a mansion. I mean, my father, so like at Buckley, and in a lot of Manhattan places, you know, there's a lot of money that's passed down. My father, he made everything that we had, and he was a hard worker.
You didn't get anything from the judge?
I think there was something that helped them buy some land in the Berkshires.
Okay.
And that's it, as far as I know. And
right.
So he made everything that he made, and he never cared about being rich.
No, and he never presented himself that way. That's
no, and he never was.
Yeah.
He never, I mean, he could have been very,
well, he was
very,
a managing partner of one of the biggest law firms in New York, wasn't he?
In the world.
Yeah, in the world.
Right, but
so that doesn't mean you're exactly poor.
Right, but you can take that money and you can make it 100 times that money just by investing it even prudently.
Yeah.
And he was not out to do that.
No, he
was not. And matter of fact, he rode the subway or walked to work every day of his life.
As did, by the way, his brother.
Yeah.
And his brother got into real trouble, you will remember, because some insane person
pushed him into the subway tracks.
Into the subway tracks.
And he ended up with 6 or 7 pins in his leg and had to show an x-ray every time he went to the airport. Yeah.
Yep, he did. And they tried the lady who pushed him into the tracks. And they found her 11-1 not guilty. And this poor lady was really, really off.
Yeah.
She found your uncle's telephone number and she would call all the time. They had to get some kind of order of protection or something like that. This is the woman who pushed him into the subway.
Yeah.
And when the one person on the jury was asked why, it was that the woman had said that her excuse for pushing him was that Jesus had told her to do it. And the other 11 voted, no, that's nonsense. She pushed him and she's guilty. But the juror would not change. And they had to try her a second time and then she was guilty. Isn't that an interesting story?
It is. It kind of it makes
may even
me
be
think
right.
That I could make a puzzle that you would like.
We're going to go back to that.
No, I'm not trying to jump back there. I'm just saying it. You know, there's a puzzle for everyone. So she's saying that Jesus told her to push him into the tracks. You know, I mean, it's a world full of all sorts of people.
Is that Zen-ish?
I don't know. How about the new Zen Allen tells me whether that's Zen-ish. You're now, whether you like it or not, Zen Allen.
I get it.
You'll probably get callers.
Well, oh, yeah. No, I think we have a lot of Zen-ish people who listen to WAMC. I don't think there's any question about it. But I want to tell you about your mom. So she's a Vanderbilt, right?
Well, that's an interesting question. I was not raised as a Vanderbilt.
Not the question.
I think
the witness will answer the question directly.
I think that there is a lineage that goes back to the Vanderbilt family. It's not one that's been a prominent part of our family.
Yeah, yeah.
And like I said, my father was a guy who walked to work every day instead of taking a company car.
That's when I told you about your Uncle Donald, because he walked to work every day instead of taking a company car and got shoved in front of the subway train.
Well, they both my mother and my father grew up during the Great Depression. So we grew up in a way where, you know, in the winter, during the day, my father would turn the furnace up to 55. I mean, you can imagine being 7 years old at night going to sleep on the top of a mountain in a house that's not winterized and it's 5 degrees out. And what he turns it down to, I think it was like 45 or 48. I don't know. It must have, like, just where the pipes maybe wouldn't freeze.
Well, you look pretty good, you know, for a guy who was raised that way.
I'm just saying that, you know, in terms of like being raised with privilege, you know, I certainly got to go to good schools and I got experiences that other people do not have the privilege of getting, which gave me a certain perspective on life. When I was in grad school, this is part of why I brought this up earlier, one of the things I realized is how privileged I am as being a dominant culture. And so I am almost every single characteristic of a dominant culture. And so that means that when I'm in a circle of people in a classroom and then the teacher asks a question, my hand goes up first. I don't have any question or hesitation about whether or not my hand's going to go up and I'm answer the question.
Isn't that just because you're smart as opposed to being in a dominant
It's
culture?
All of it. It's all of it. It's that I have no fear. I have no fear. I don't have a lineage of people who were treated as less than the cream of the crop. And so because of that, and my grad school got me to recognize that. And there's nothing I can do about that. That's my past. That's who I am. It's part of who I am. But what I can do is recognize that and be aware of it so I'm not arrogant, and then recognize where other people and other cultures and other thinkers, you know, have more hesitation, and be aware of how a team works and think of the whole entire world as being one team trying to work together, and, you know, what can help in being effective towards us all working together as a team.
So you believe that? I mean, you know, the great Pete Seeger question that we asked him a number of times was, what do you think about people? You know, are they basically good or are they basically evil? And, you know, I think he thought that they were evil. that basically they were not on a team. They were screwed up.
I've had a fair share of near-death experiences, and I've had a fair share of bad things happen in my life from things that were not fair, you know? And I don't believe that those people were necessarily evil. Their actions certainly were not appropriate towards a peaceful world. But, for instance, getting mugged in New York City. A lot of New Yorkers get mugged. Like, it's a kind of a, not a rite of passage, but...
Did you get mugged?
I got mugged, yeah.
And you don't think the guy who hit you over the head was evil?
No.
I do.
I don't think he was evil. I think there is reasoning to be understood about what led him to be in that situation. My I Ching always tells me...
I'm sorry, who was that?
I Ching, the I Ching.
And where's the I Ching come from?
The I Ching is a text that's been around for thousands of years that has to do with Eastern philosophies and Taoism. And so I do my I Ching every morning, and quite often...
When you do your I Ching, exactly what do?
Well, it's normally you're throwing coins and six coins and they form hexagrams, and then you read the hexagrams and they have changing lines and things. But now there's an app, you know, where it throws them for you.
I got it.
And so it's much easier to do it. So there's, this, you know, it's basic reminders of life. Nothing is very, you know, it's not anything that you don't necessarily think of yourself. It just reminds you to be true to your nature and who you are, and, you know, about having compassion for others. And one of the things it constantly tells me, or that I read in it constantly, is about not forgetting, but forgiving. So forgiving, but not forgetting. We don't forget, like, when someone's wronged us, or I don't forget necessarily when someone's wronged me, but where am I going to get? What am I going to create in life if I'm filled? If what I'm filling myself with is hatred and vengeance and seeking revenge and that, how is that going to help me create clean water for the entire planet or help communities in need that are generations of people trapped in debt in various countries or in our own country, people who are underserved, where insurance companies may be denying babies $2,000 claims for surgeries that then they end up dying? Because they're in an underserved population where there aren't any lawyers and they don't know how to combat them or things like there's no good education, there's no health clinics, there's no clean water, the groundwater is all contaminated and no one's doing anything about it. People who are disenfranchised and there's not, you know, our market system has failures and someone needs to take those up, or I believe that someone needs to take up the responsibility of meeting those underserved areas where the market breaks down. I'm a businessman, so I'm not, I mean, I do believe in business, but it doesn't serve everything. So what I've done with this company is start, it's both a mission-driven and a profit-driven company, that we want to make a lot of profits as much as we can, but we want to use those profits to do good. So we're not profitable yet. Hopefully in the next 12 months, we'll start to be profitable. Well, we have started to be profitable.
Okay, Will, wait a second. Just in case somebody's just tuning in now,
yeah,
we are talking to Will Carswell. He's the founder and CEO of Zen Art and Design in Northampton. By the way, anybody who's listening now can find out more about this wonderful company, www.zenartdesign.com. Zenartdesign is one word, .com. So, Will, I love our conversation, by the way. I'm really having fun. I think you're a very bright guy, and we have certain things we share together, certain things we don't. Somebody wants to kill me or take my money and bat me over the head. I understand, as Officer Kropke may have sang in West Side Story, you know, you've got a social disease and that's his problem. But you always have to take responsibility. And that guy should have had responsibility before he hit you over the head.
Yeah, I'm not saying let him go free.
Mm-hmm. But you're saying you could forgive him.
I'm saying that at times it's absolutely necessary to forgive him.
No, I watched that story, that incredible story, I guess, last year of the church, right? You remember there was a black church down south, and a guy comes in and he kills a whole bunch of people in there, in the congregants, and they forgive him. They forgive the guy. They said, we're not going to forget it, just as you said, but we'll forgive him.
One of the things my I Ching says all the time, and that I fully believe, regardless of whether the I Ching says it or not, and I've learned it from other trainings as well that have nothing to do with Eastern philosophies, is that what I bring to my day or my moment, my life, is my offering to the day. And if what I'm bringing is hatred and vengeance, there is no room for abundance. The emptier that I am, the more room I have for abundance to enter. And so, and without abundance, what am I giving to other people? How can I be of service to other people if all I am full of is hatred or seeking vengeance and not forgiveness? So in order to have that kind of peace and abundance and room inside my soul or whatever, I need to be able to be free and be at peace and forgive people. I'm not saying that's an easy task or that I always do it effectively. I'm not claiming whatsoever to be able to do that perfectly. And every day I fall short, and every day I try, sometimes every moment.
So I take it you're voting for Donald Trump?
No, I'm not.
No, I figured based on what you had just said that that was the antithesis of his philosophy of what you said. So let me tell you a little something, because it's a conversation I get to talk to. And, you know, as you probably know, my aunt, my mother's sister, who I loved and who paid for every suit I ever had and who gave me my first car and everything, my aunt had a daughter, and the daughter, Lois, married your uncle,
yeah,
Donald, and who is a major vice president of NBC for most of his life. And she became the head of the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens, and she did all this great work, and she was fabulous. And she's been on this station. She used to come up here with Snowy the Owl. When they were lobbying the legislature, they used to always bring somebody up here, and it was almost always Snowy the Owl. And she'd come in, and we'd do that, and we'd run stories in the Legislative Gazette, because she was an extraordinary woman. Anyway, the reason I'm telling you this, I think, is because by being her first cousin, you see, that made me related to the Vanderbilts. Don't you see? She was married to Donald. Donald was, of course, married. Now, what was Donald's relationship to?
He was my father's brother.
That's
so
right.
He was my mother's brother-in-law.
I'm my own grandpa, don't you see? So, as a result of that, I took claim to being related to the Vanderbilts. And I want you to know that I had a guy, I'm not going to use his name, who worked here and who was directly related to the Vanderbilts. And every time I saw that guy, and I think I annoyed him the hell out of him, I used to say, "Hello, cousin." That wasn't supposed to be the Jewish kid from Manhattan. But it all shows how one-worldly we all are. It all comes around.
Well, there's another.
Are you looking at me strangely here?
Well, no, I've just got me thinking, you know, there's another part of this where, I mean, I was adopted. I was born in Morocco, Africa.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and I was adopted in New York City in 1970. So for me, my actual first blood are my two young sons. And so for me, the entire, although.
What do you mean first blood? I'm sorry. I don't get that.
I don't have any other actual blood in this world.
Oh, I see. Other than, well, you have it, that you know, but you obviously came from somewhere.
I did. Well, although there was the possibility I could have been a test tube baby. It was 1970. You have no idea.
Nah.
I could have been chemically engineered. In my 30s, I found out, it turns out I'm 100% Irish, and the mystery was gone. I didn't...
You sent it into Ancestry.com? And
no, I just was able to find out my non-identifying background information.
I see.
So it turns out my maternal grandfather was a marketing guy and some other things. But anyway, so for me, my mother has always been my mother. My father's always been... My family's always been my family. You know, they're...
Of course.
They were from the start. And
of
it was
course.
As if I wasn't adopted. You know, I mean, and it was from a young age. I mean,
sure.
I was, you know, a baby. But it also means to me that, you know, there can be family in the entire world. So there are people that I've met on a Greyhound bus or in school or in anywhere else. They could be, it could be you, you know, and we develop a relationship that is such, it is akin to family. And so I definitely feel an openness towards that. And so, I mean, I don't connect with Vanderbilt. I don't connect with lineage. I connect with the people I connect with. And it makes
I hear you, and
no
I,
difference to
I
me.
Apologize for bringing it up.
Well, it makes no difference to me. Like, I never knew my father's parents. I never knew them. I've heard stories about them. As a matter of fact, I didn't really hear stories about them until more recently. I knew almost next to nothing about them. And my mother's family is my mother's family. And so it's all a big, you know, like the rest of the world, a big hodgepodge. I mean, I spent most of my life, or a lot of my life anyway, working minimum wage jobs, like in
like
Colorado.
What?
I remember working at a pet and feed store in Boulder, Colorado. I would walk 4 miles in the snow to work for $3 an hour to unload thousands of pounds of feed from trucks.
We stopped too long ago on your biography. So the last thing we knew, you had gone to where? To what college?
Milton Academy.
No, to Milton Academy, and then to?
And then I went around the country. I didn't go to college. I mean, I eventually went to college.
Well, and how long did you go around the country?
A few years.
What'd your parents think?
That is not what they wanted for me.
And then when you got done walking around the country, you went where?
I went to Hampshire College for writing and photography, which right. I loved. And a guy named Ray Coppinger and Stanley Warner taught a course called Inter-American Environmental Economics. And the first thing Ray said, he was this very gruff guy, but he was actually he was a soft guy. Once you got to know him, he was amazing, amazing guy. And they both, especially Ray, instilled in me what I later went to grad school for. The first thing they said...
Did you graduate from...
No, I left Hampshire.
Where'd you go to?
UMass.
UMass.
Yeah, Hampshire was a wonderful school, but there was no structure. There were no exams, no grades. And I was raised in a very structured way. And, you know, I needed grades and exams.
Yeah, me too. And I went gone to the New Lincoln School. Same deal.
Yeah.
Left there. Same reason. But I'm going to tell you, this whole idea of Hampshire, I've often thought the guys who go to Harvard, the smart kids who go to Harvard, they should probably go to Hampshire because they're structured. The people who go to Hampshire probably ought to go to Harvard.
Yeah. Well, it's a very different kind of environment, and you need to be very disciplined. And I'm not sure I had the discipline at that time.
Yeah.
I mean, plenty of times in my life, I've worked 100 hours a week for maybe 3 months. And then I would do nothing for like a month, and I would work. You know, and I realized that I like to work in a project-based way. And now I've been working 100 hours a week for the past 5 years and sleeping 4 hours a night, and it's just been this continuous thing. I mean, I didn't think it was possible. I did not think it was possible to sleep 4 hours a night. I literally slept 4 hours a night for 2.5 years, and I don't know what I'm up to
Join
now.
Join the club.
Yeah, and then...
You begin to hallucinate after a while.
Well, I got used to it. I got used to it, and my body got used to it, and, you know, you just make time for other things like, you know, anything else by sleeping less. So there were times where I would work 40 straight hours or 24 straight hours in starting this company, and it takes a lot to start a startup.
I stopped you, Will Carswell, when you began to talk about growing this company. First of all, let's get it established. When did you start the company?
I began starting it in 2012, and we launched sales in 2014, launched wholesale in 2015. So
of the puzzles, of these hand-cut puzzles.
Well, now they're laser cut. So I was hoping to be able to talk a little more about the history of jigsaw puzzles, but I can probably do it very, very briefly.
Well, we have 17 minutes. Go ahead. You have all the time you want.
All right. Well, I can do it for about 24 straight hours, but I'll do it in,
well,
No, not none of your listeners, nor do you want to hear about 24 straight hours about
But they are interested in a guy who had this incredible, bright educational background and who has ended up as one of the master puzzle makers in the United States, which is extraordinary, and it's a great story. So at what point, because you had been making puzzles since you were 12, did you say, this is what I ought to be doing?
There was a time, well, 5 years ago, when I wanted to do more than what I was doing, which had been, I had been investing. I was a private investor. And
did you make a lot of money?
I did.
So you have some money.
No, I went through a divorce and lost it all.
All?
Yeah, all of it.
How can you lose all of it in a divorce?
That's a good question.
You're supposed to get half.
I know, and six lawyers could not tell me why, but anyway. So it was starting over, and it's been an amazing experience. The adventure of starting anew and looking around and seeing what you have and what you can build reminded me of when I was like 7 in first grade being in recess, and I was the guy, I mean, I loved playing sports and football and things like that, but I also loved being just sitting there in the woods and taking twigs and making a building out of it. And the things that were around me and seeing what I could create out of them. And I create all the time. Matter of fact, when I was starting this company, I had to work very, very hard not to start a new company every day and incorporate it every day. And if I didn't stop myself, it wasn't just product lines. Like, there were hundreds of products that I would come out with. There was a brand new company every day I wanted to start. And I had to limit myself and calm down and just stick with, you know, the one thing. So I started starting it in 2012. First, I had to figure out how to make them. So what I used to sell for $1,000... Okay, this requires a little brief history of the wooden jigsaw puzzle, because why would a puzzle be $1,000? In 1760, a map maker called John Spilsbury, that was his name, was a cartographer, and he taught the British elite, the children of the British elite, geography. And so the jigsaw puzzle is attributed to him. And in 1760, he took a map, mounted it to wood, and cut it into various pieces. They didn't interlock. He just cut them into different pieces. And they were the different countries of the British Empire. And these were the lands that the kids would be ruling. So they needed to understand the geography. And that's how it started. It was an elite product for an elite group. And that's how it continued, the wooden jigsaw puzzle, for a couple of centuries. But it soon became very popular. You know, people used other images, and it became fun. And then adults wanted to do them. And by the 1800s, they were interlocking at times. And they also had something called the push-pull puzzle that didn't interlock. So if you bumped it, the whole thing came apart. And then they made trays for them that contained them. And all sorts of people joined into making these. And there's an incredibly interesting and rich socioeconomic and cultural history to the jigsaw puzzle that I'd like to make into a documentary with a documentary maker that I have in mind that I hope to be able to convince to make this with me, because I think it's a fantastic story. But in very, very brief, between sometime in the 1800s and, say, the 1930s, there were all of these artisans, all these craftspeople who, some of them weren't even craftspeople, who joined into making these because there was a market for them. So, and most of these people are anonymous. So now to find them is like a rich find, sure, to be able to find the name of the person who made these puzzles. And they would join in and they would hand cut them, and they would make one or 20 or whatever they did, and they would sell them. And
would those be worth a lot of money at antique roadshow right now?
To the right person, yes. To the wrong person, no. And almost the entire world, nobody's ever heard of it. For instance, the wooden jigsaw puzzle market in the United States is a $25 million market per year. The cardboard puzzle market in the United States is somewhere between $600 million and a billion. Mm-hmm. So the premium wooden jigsaw puzzle market is a fraction of the cardboard puzzle market. And almost no one's ever heard of them, because it's always been this elite product. And so there's more to the story, but basically in the 1930s, Parr Puzzles developed themselves. And from 1936 to 1974, they were the premier makers of wooden jigsaw puzzles. And they set the standards to which all modern day puzzle cutters adhere. But in the 1930s, and this is an important point, that the hydraulic press emerged and allowed the die cutting of cardboard puzzles. And that's when the cardboard puzzle came about. Although there had been attempts to make cardboard puzzles apparently before that, that's when they became popularized and became this huge fad. And the way it started was large companies would make them and they'd put their toothpaste or their soap on them, and they would to advertise them, and they would give them away for free.
Interesting.
This was the Great Depression. Nobody had any money. Nobody had any food. Nobody had any jobs. They were losing everything. They had one piece of furniture left they hadn't burned to stay warm. And the companies realized that people loved them, and they started putting images on them and selling them for a dime. They were called weeklies. And every week, and families would wait for them to come out, and they would go buy them every Friday. And for a dime, they would get this entertainment. They no longer had any money. They couldn't bring the kids out to the movies or wherever they were going, or they couldn't even eat. And they would go get these. And the cardboard puzzle, which is a cheap knockoff of the real thing, is missing most of the features. It's not thick wood. It's missing the figural pieces that are charming pieces that look like horses or people dancing or whatever they are that are actual pieces in the puzzle. They don't have any of that. They're just a template that's just, you change the image, cut another one. Change the image, cut another one. Change the image, cut another one. The same thing over and over and over. So people think that's what a puzzle is. That's not really what a puzzle is. It's a cheap knockoff of the real thing. But in the Great Depression, it is literally, literally one of the things that held families together during this decade of strife. They're sitting there starving. You know, people are dying. They have nothing. They have no hope. They have nothing to hope for. And then the government's trying to do things. They're creating, you know, various programs that are helping. They've got food lines. So I'm not saying they're not getting any hope from anywhere else, but this is something that kept families together and gave them hope. They would sit around the piano stool or whatever they had left and do this puzzle, and that held them together during this entire decade. And it became this wildly popular fad. And that's what popularized the jigsaw puzzle. And the wooden puzzle continued to be a very expensive product for many, many years, and until now. And the cardboard puzzles, what everyone knew. So when I introduced this company, I used to sell my puzzles for thousands of dollars. I used to sell for $1,000. My main competitor, who is the majority of the premium wooden jigsaw puzzle market today, the puzzle I would sell for $1,000, he would sell for $4,700. And he would sell them for up to $10,000, and still does. And people buy them. And so I had clients who would buy my $1,000 puzzles, and I did it as a hobby, and I was an investor, and I didn't really need the money. I did it because I loved it, and those were the prices they commanded. And I had lots of people who wanted to come, and they wanted to buy them for a couple $100. And these were people who I knew didn't make enough money to be even spending a couple $100 on a gift. And they wanted to buy them for other people. And lots of people, and so many people over the decades, that I wanted to start this company that would bring the what had always been an elite product to the mainstream. So I developed a way to make it available to the mainstream. And now, after a couple of years of testing constantly for 1 year on various equipment, and then I bought some equipment, the laser equipment, and tested and made a product on it. And it took, I mean, just literally a year of sitting in my basement testing on this laser, of logging every single test and trying all sorts of different substrates and papers and coatings and all sorts of different things that you could test. And I mean, it's unbelievable. And put, you know, 100 hours a week in or more to testing, I came out with the product. And now what I used to sell for $1,000, we make a better puzzle, but we retail it for $80. Wow. And so what I used to sell for $500, we retail for $40. And we've got puzzles that sell from between $8 and $80.
So how do they compare in quality to your main competitor, of whom you don't want to say anything else about?
Well, in this book that I'm holding in my hand by Ann Williams, she was a professor of economics at Bates College. And she's a world-renowned puzzle expert, wooden puzzle expert. She's got a very large collection. I've never met her. I would love to meet her, by the way. I would love to have a conversation with her.
We'll send her a CD of this conversation. Yeah. She'll write right back to you.
So she wrote one of the only histories of the wooden jigsaw puzzle that's ever been written. There's a few books, maybe five, that touch upon it. She wrote this. I was actually listed on page 204 as one of 23 hand cutters in the United States under the first W.C. Puzzles, Will Carswell Puzzles. W.C. Puzzles was before it became the Berkshire Puzzle Company. And there were maybe five of us in there that really made, I don't want to be limiting. I mean, there were more, but we made great puzzles. And there were a lot of other people who made puzzles, and plenty of them were good. But there were five of us that I,
so now how many people are making puzzles in your new company?
I mean, how many people are in my company making them?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's an interdependent effort. So in my company, there are a certain amount of cutters on the lasers. So it depends on how many we're producing at the time.
Well, but how many of them are Will Carswell, as opposed to, because I have a feeling your puzzle is going to be worth big money someday. And how many of them are Will Carswell, you? And how many other people do you have to employ to get where you want to get to?
Well, we've been able to do a lot with very little. It's been an amazing experience. I mean, both in terms of equipment, space, employees. From starting a startup, I mean, the efficiencies that we've gained and what we've learned, we've been able to do a lot with a very little. So at the moment, we have three production operatives who cut on the lasers. We have two lasers and we have one shift. We've had two shifts in the past, and we'll go back to two shifts. And what we have is a very replicable model Well, we can expand to producing 10 times as much we produce.
But when you do it, are you going to, Will Carswell, you were telling me earlier that you have a plan for the proceeds from these puzzles.
Yeah. And so eventually, when we're profitable, we'll give certain, we'll give a portion of profits to certain causes. And we also will do things like create puzzles that are dedicated to fundraising for certain causes. Eventually, when we're profitable enough, I want to start a venture philanthropy subsidiary fund that just donates millions of dollars every year to philanthropic causes, but not just giving money away. I want to be involved. I want to give more than money. I want to be giving resources away. I want my employees to have paid volunteer opportunities to go build hospitals in Somalia or teach education in Washington, D.C., or build a health clinic in rural Florida or whatever they're doing, disaster relief. Well, you know, and it's not taking away from their vacation time. What we can do in the meantime, and what we have done is, for instance, last November, December, I think maybe it was just December, every order on our website, we gave puzzles to families in needs in need through a nonprofit called Project Just Because in Hopkinton, Mass. And then, of course, a family in need doesn't need a puzzle. They need food, water, shelter, you know, warmth. But it's nice when you can't afford the heat to get a present, you know, and for your kids and your family to get a present, you know, that you wouldn't be able to afford. So that's what we were able to do. We don't make heat. We make puzzles. So we were able to give those. So that's what we can do in the meantime before we're profitable. We're about to donate a cow to Heifer International to a family in Rwanda, a community in Rwanda, and it's an extraordinary thing. You can look at Heifer International. They're one of my favorite nonprofits ever. What they do is way more than just give. It's like teach a man to fish, you know.
Well, who's a man to fish?
Teach a person to fish, I should say.
I'm just kidding.
They give a cow and then training, and then the cows breed, and then they have the whole community has cows, and they have milk, and they can sell the milk, and then they have multiple cows, and they've got sources of protein, and now they've gotten a growing economy and all sorts of things. So it's more than giving a cow. So there's things that we can do in the meantime before we're profitable that we do to be philanthropic and to be mission driven.
So what makes you think you're going to hit it this big that you can get all that money to give out? What's the prognosis?
Well, when I started this company, I said I knew the puzzle that I can make. And
when you say the puzzle, you mean all the puzzles that you're making, right? You
didn't mean. I mean all the puzzles. Yeah. The way that we make our puzzles. Yeah. I know there's an artistry to puzzles, and it's lost on the cardboard puzzle. I mean, the cardboard puzzles, like I said, is die cut. And the actual art of puzzlery is the design of the cuts. It's not the image that's on it. And it's the way that the substrate is constructed. So you've got we've got FSC certified wood we have custom made for us. It's trees grown in the United States, harvested in the United States, manufactured in the United States. It's custom made for us.
But the pieces themselves are not just any pieces. They're pieces that are designed somehow to be quite special, aren't they?
Correct. Matter of fact, I'm going to lean over here for a second and show this to you. I brought you this puzzle, and what we do is put a showcase tray on the top of our Zen puzzles, and this is Blue Parrot. So all these parrots that I'm showing you, Alan...
Well, that's unbelievable.
These are pieces in the puzzle.
Is every piece in the puzzle a parrot?
No.
No.
And those are all different parrots. There's underneath here, underneath the showcase tray, there are a couple things. They're the normal pieces that are more regular looking, but each one of these is unique, and it's unique from every other puzzle that we make. I mean, if you bought 20 of the same size, same image of the same size, you'd have most likely the same exact puzzle, unless I made a version change. But no one's going to do that. So they essentially act as one-offs, just like when I hand cut them. You buy one of the 61 smalls that we have available, they're all going to be completely unique. The other thing that's in the box is this puzzle history booklet, because these are heirloom quality. And in my family, and this relates to how it keeps families together, we would sign the bottom of the box every time we did it. So we'd pull a puzzle out of our collection. Some family comes from Canada, or somebody visiting from France, or somebody gets married, somebody's born, or we just feel like doing a puzzle. Pull it out of the collection, we do it, and everyone who did it, we put the date, and everyone initials the bottom of the box by that date. So after 50 years, you look back, and it's got the puzzle itself has this entire history of every time it's been done. All these family members, some of them are gone now, some of them, you know, you want to remember, and it's got a history of its own. So I made this puzzle history booklet inside the Zen Puzzles box, and I tell them about the tradition of my family, and I say each time the box is opened, you know, put the date down, and it's got all these pages in it to write the date down, and everyone who does it needs to initial it themselves, ideally. Now, after 500 years, I want this puzzle to have all these different names in it so that my great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather did this puzzle, you know, and then it passed on, and all these different people and family and friends not only struggled, we put things in like trickery, like false corners and false borders and things like that, and they struggled with the same trickery that, you know, I did, or that my father did, or that my mother did, or these family friends, and they've written it in this book. Maybe they wrote a note, You know, I don't know. And it's all these people that not only touch the pieces, and you know that you look at the book and you see that it held these people together, brought them together to do the puzzle together, but they've actually struggled mentally with the same, you know, human cognitive, you know, abilities that we have over time. And so it brings us together with our humanity. It through time, I'm the same person, regardless of the digital age or an industrial age or what age it is. It's this constant that we're always struggling with our obstacles and with the things that are with us and our needs and wants and how to get them and what means what to us.
Well,
this is a constant throughout generations and generations that can be passed down from generation to generation to reflect really our own humanity of struggling and enjoying life.
I love that idea, Will Carswell. And I must say, this is just gorgeous. I can't believe these parrots that are part of the set for this one production. We are out of time. We've been talking to Will Carswell. I just love this conversation, Will. I want to thank you for it.
Thank you, Alan.
Founder and CEO of Zen Art and Design in Northampton, one of our favorite places. You can also find out more at www.zenartdesign.com. Will, again, thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Alan Chartok.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store. Thank you.